Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 62, sponsored this week by the fine people at Checkpoint Software. This is the last Risky Business before the biggest security conference in Australia kicks off this Sunday. AusCert's annual conference on the Gold Coast is always a ripper, and I'm looking forward to catching up with everyone when I get there. So if you see me walking around with a Risky Business t-shirt on, by all means, say hello. Now, we won't be doing a regular Risky Business from the conference. Instead, we'll be setting up a special site at itradio.com.au/AusCert08. It's not there yet, but it will be shortly. There I hope to add anywhere between 5 and 12 hours of audio content from the conference, including both presentations and interviews. Microsoft has been kind enough to sponsor IT Radio's coverage of the whole event. Now don't worry about remembering, I'll be sure to push out an audio reminder through the regular RSS feed featuring a summary of that day's coverage. But that's next week's problem. In this week's show, we're speaking to Dave Endler. He's the director of Tipping Point's DV Labs and the chairman of the VoIP Security Alliance. Before working for Tipping Point, Endler worked at iDefence, pioneering the concept of cache for vulnerabilities. Anyway, Tipping Point flew me to Sydney so I could attend their press briefing and have a chat to Dave about software as a service bugs. Sitting in your bedroom and hacking an IIS box over a local LAN is one thing, but spending your time trying to pwn Salesforce.com or go to my PC is a completely different matter, not just technically but ethically as well. Dave will be along soon to talk about that. In this week's sponsor interview, we spoke to Checkpoint's Steve McDonald. He disagrees with both BT Counterpane's Bruce Schneier and RSA Security's Art Coviello. They both say there won't be pure-play information security vendors in the future. Consolidation will mean that basically security becomes a subset of a broader offering, but McDonald has his own views on that. Oh, and as it turns out, this is kind of interesting to you Mac users out there, and a few people in security are known to use Macs, but Checkpoint's PointSec division has released a full disk crypto tool for Macs that Checkpoint customers can go and download from their customer download area. So I know a lot of people have been waiting for that sort of software, so off you go and go nuts. And if it's good, let us know. If it's bad, let us know. Always want to hear that sort of feedback. But before we get into all of that, as always, it is time for a check of this week's news headlines with ZDNet Australia's editor, Munir Katadia. And Munir, it seems researchers have figured out how to use Google Mail servers or Gmail boxes to send copious amounts of spam. That's the pig in the can.
Yeah, too right. Apparently Google has a 500 address bulk email limit and some identity fraud protections. And these guys, the Information Security Research Team, or INSERT as they're known, have managed to create a proof of concept that exploits it.
Yeah, well, apparently it exploits the quote-unquote trust hierarchy. I mean, everyone trusts Gmail servers. I think that's kind of what they're getting at there.
That's right, yeah.
I saw this last week. It popped into some Silk channel I was in, and it linked through to PacketStorm and then linked through to their paper. And they've been a little bit coy on how this whole thing works, but probably for good reason, because if they were if they provided too much detail, I think we'd see a lot of the spammers exploiting this. But they were able to send 4,000 messages in one go through the Gmail servers, and they reckon that they could have – there was no countermeasure that kicked in, so they could have really just started going bonkers with it.
Well, you know, Gmail's got such a massive infrastructure there, so it's not a surprise that people are trying to attack it.
Well, and of course, if there is this single point of weakness, I mean, they seem generally pretty good on stuff like this, Google.
Yeah.
But, of course, because there is this one weakness, I think it's caught them by surprise. And, let's just hope they can tighten it all up and before the bad guys found out, and then we start seeing Gmail becoming a source of spam. Let's just hope. I bet you there's a bunch of boffins working on this right now. So if you're listening, guys, good one.
Yeah, sort it out quick.
That's right. Now, this is our next story. It's more of a business piece, I guess, but it is interesting. For American listeners and for overseas listeners, you might want to listen to this, because what's happened here in Australia is eBay has issued an edict which says that all payments must actually go through PayPal.
Yeah.
Now, they've said that this is a security initiative, but obviously it's an anti-competitive money grab. Well, you know, that's some people's take on it anyway, and I'm going to certainly enjoy my annual catch-up with Alastair McGibbon, who's their Director of Trust and Safety at AUSCERT next week. give me something to tease him about over a beer. But yeah, look, it looks like the ACCC, which is the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission, is waiting for eBay's response to the tap on the shoulder that the ACCC gave it.
Yeah, that's right. And they've had interested parties that have lodged statements, apparently. The Australian Bankers Association, Reserve Bank of Australia, and Australian Securities and Investments Commission. So a pretty serious bunch there.
Yeah, I think by interested parties, I think they mean enraged consumer advocacy groups.
yeah, good way.
Yeah. But, I mean, interested parties is another one. So we've got to wait until the 23rd of May to see what eBay has to say for itself in response to all of the criticism that's coming towards it. But it looks like this move, you know, I'm surprised they didn't try to introduce this in a less regulated market. My feeling is that eBay are doing this in Australia to see how it washes. And if it's successful, they're going to do it in the States as well, and the UK, and, you know, everywhere else, basically. Is
that
your
feeling?
Well,
for their business, it makes an awful lot of sense. But, you know, it just seems daft, really. It's like, okay, you can use our site and you can only pay for stuff using our system as well. I don't like it.
Look, no one likes it, but it makes great business sense. When you've got a monopoly on, you know, this huge chunk of global commerce, and you've got they've got a banker's license, basically, here in Australia. So they can wind up making a lot of money, a lot more money out of PayPal than they can out of eBay. The question, I suppose, on the Australian regulators' minds is whether or not it's legal. This next piece is kind of interesting. It seems that there's a new good phishing tool. And I think I've heard of these before, but, you know, there's another one that's just come out which lets companies basically do social engineering attacks on their own staff using a phishing tool, and they see who gets suckered in, and then they can go and kick them up the bum.
It's a real smart idea. I mean, I've heard of government departments and a few other people actually doing this, and yeah, they launch an attack against their own people and see what kind of stuff that they fall for, and it gives them a good way of going there in the next meeting and saying, oh, you're rubbish, don't, like, you know, try and open pictures of Anna Kournikova or whatever it may be.
You know, I'm in two minds about this sort of stuff. I think it could be positive if it's done right. I just wouldn't like to see insensitive people implementing this, like turning up to someone's desk one day and going, you jackass, you know, you clicked on this and, hey, you know, you should bloody know better and things like that. I think we've got to take the softly approach with the old staff, but certainly will be interesting. You know, I'd be curious to see some results of test results taken at different times. So they do it once and see how many people click through and do all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, take that test again at 3 months and then at 6 months and see if people actually learn, because it's all well and good as an idea, but unless people are actually learning, then it's not much good. Now, in proof that it pays to continuously scan your servers, Mozilla has stopped distributing a Vietnamese language pack for Firefox after discovering it had been infected by malicious code for 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, Mozilla is saying that they usually do a complete virus scan of all of their software that it's going to make publicly available, but the scanners failed to detect this piece of malware.
Well, it's probably because the signature for this particular threat wasn't available at the time that they scanned it and then put it online.
Yep.
And that's how it was able to sit there infecting people for 2 months. But, you know, this goes part in parcel with the whole conversation we've been having on the show about antivirus and about, you know, the criticisms leveled against it, I suppose, at Microsoft's Blue Hat conference and also by Simon Howard, who's the organiser of the Race to Zero competition. You know, signature-based AV has a lot of problems. It doesn't mean you shouldn't use it, but this is a perfect example of the signatures being behind the threats.
Yeah, totally. And because of that, more than 16,000 people have downloaded it and probably been infected.
Yay! That's fantastic. All right. And now this next item is, frankly, a little bit upsetting, and I'm sure everyone's seen it. It was very big news, but some complete jackass posted a bunch of flashing images and links to a Epilepsy Foundation site, and it triggered migraines and near seizures for some visitors.
Crazy this is. I mean, why would you do this? I don't understand. But apparently what they did was that there were posts on the forums there, and people have put animated GIFs and links to other websites, which, you know, when you click on the link, then it takes you to something which is even more crazy. And obviously the people that are using it are epileptic, and they've been having some real issues. It's a complete
nightmare.
Yeah,
the idea was to actually trigger epileptic fits in people. And, you know, I just, what a stupid f***ing thing to do. You know, like honest to God, like that is what is the point of doing something like that? I mean, that's the biggest act of jackassery I've seen on the net, I think, ever. I mean, do you know how serious an epileptic seizure is?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And it's just daft. There's no reason for this. It's just a complete bunch of idiots. You're right.
Yeah, no, and I hope whoever did this, the FBI is investigating, you know, and I really hope they put the entire team on it. And even if they don't manage to convict someone, at least arrest them so they get the phone book treatment when they're brought in for questioning, you know.
Mate, you know, there's one thing you can do. You can go and you can infect someone's machine and, you know, it can be annoying and they'll have some strange adverts or whatever on. But actually, like, physically hurting them is just plain unacceptable. Ridiculous.
Whoever did this could have killed someone. So
yeah, true.
God knows what would possess someone to do that. But there you go. Some moron has posted a bunch of stuff into an epileptics forum. I think they used some sort of cross-site scripting bug or something like that, which is why it got the hacker's angle. But it sounds like a pretty lame... it sounds like it was pretty lame technically, but big news, so I figured we'd cover it. But,
yeah, and the Epilepsy Foundation has said that they've changed their system now so that you can't put animated GIFs and you can't put direct links to our outside, so it should hopefully stop them for now.
Yeah, but they shouldn't have to do that, you know?
Yeah, like, that's true.
Anyway. So on this next piece, great piece, I definitely recommend people read. Oh, speaking of pieces that I recommend people read, there's currently a piece on Security Focus right now, which is a very interesting, provides a very interesting insight into the world of these teenage kids who get roped into writing botnets and stuff.
Hmm.
So I'm just trying to find the headline of the piece.
I haven't read this one myself.
It's called Thoughts of a Teenage Botmaster, and it's by Dan Gooden from The Register, and it's just been reprinted on SecFocus, where I stop by sometimes. But
yeah,
definitely, it's a probably like a 2,000-word feature or something, and it's definitely worth a look. But also worth a look is a piece written by your journalist, Liam Tung, who's been on this program a few times, entitled ATO Admits Staff Have Lost Data, Sent Porn Emails. I bet you were the one who put the headline on it.
It's becoming a bit obvious which ones I do, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I tell you what, you know, you're expecting a pretty sensationalised piece there, but once you get into it, it's a really good feature on the security culture at the Australian Taxation Office, what's happened, what they've done about it. They've had a big survey of their 22,000 staff, but please tell us all about this, Manir.
Yeah, basically, and before I go into this, I've got to say the CIO, Bill Gibson, has been fantastic about this. You know, I mean, we called him up and said, hey, what's going on? Because this PricewaterhouseCoopers thing, expecting him to just clam up and say, no comment. But he was so open with this and admitted that, yes, you know, they've had a load of issues. They've lost disks. They've had staff that have been fired because they've been found sending porn via email. And he was really open with it. And, you know, as we're moving into a time where, you know, data disclosure is becoming so important and we're hoping it's going to be law, this is the kind of thing, this is the way we hope that all the other CIOs of big agencies will behave.
Well, look, I've got to say, I was very impressed because, and that's what makes this story worth reading, is that he was so bloody open about it. And he said, oh yeah, look, we lost a briefcase with some taxpayer information on two individuals. We lost a disc. It was lost for a while, but we got it back. And, you know, and they're really talking about why they're getting data leakage problems. So they're, you know, I mean, it's instances like this where you can kind of see what DLP, data loss prevention, is getting a lot of shit from security guys out there. But you can really see, reading through this sort of case study, why it would be useful. He says that most of the time, it's insecure transfer channels. So people using thumb drives and stuff to swap data and interagency data. There's no sort of agreed upon protocol. So people are just emailing shit back and forth and like doing all of that stuff that DLP is designed to prevent. So I'm 9/10 of the way turned around and starting to think that DLP could be a good idea.
Yeah, and the other thing he comes out here, which is a really good one, is that, you know, when people are sending out emails and other information and they have this classification system where, you know, this particular data you can classify, you know, it's secret or whatever, you're not allowed to let it out. And these guys are thinking, well, I know that if I choose this particular classification level, I'm not going to be able to get it to that person that needs to get it on time. So they're just lower or they choose the wrong one, and it's all about convenience.
Well, this is an age-old problem, isn't it, that the user will always circumvent a security control if it helps them to do, you know, if it prevents them from doing their job in a way that they would like to do their job.
Yeah, simple, but now it's out in the open, you know, there's going to be a far fewer than that they're actually doing that kind of thing now.
Mm-mm. But yeah, look, everyone, I command thee, go to zdnet.com.au/news or Google for this piece. It's called ATO Admits Staff Have Lost Data, Sent Porn Emails. Everyone go and read that piece by Liam Tung, because it's a very good read. He's come along great guns on his InfoSec reporting.
He has indeed, and he's going to be at AusCert doing a whole load of stuff there.
Oh,
next
now
week as well.
Everyone's going to be at AusCert. Of course, now I should point out that Risky Business will not be doing regular programming next week. I'm going to be down at, up at the AusCert conference. Doing an absolute stack of audio. So we're going to be recording a lot of the presentations, doing a bunch of interviews. We're the official podcast of the conference. And Munir, you and I are teaming up on a slightly different thing.
We are indeed. We're going to kind of do the equivalent of this for my blog on ZDNet. So that should be kind of interesting. We're going to do it on video as well. So let's see how that goes.
Yeah, you can see that I've got a fantastic face for radio.
Yeah, and we'll see if we can drag a few of the other people in there as well. I love also. It's pretty much the best show of the year. Highlight for me.
Yeah, now we're putting up a website. It's not there yet, but by the time the conference rolls around, you'll be able to go to itradio.com.au/AusCert08. And there you will find basically content that will be appearing as I record it. I mean, I'm going to record it and bang, put it straight on there. Our production guy, Josh Bell, God love him, he's coming with us. So it's going to be a huge conference. We've got a stack of great interviews lined up. Microsoft has actually sponsored IT Radio's coverage of the event. And it's just going to be fantastic. I'm going to be working my ass off, but it's going to be fantastic.
It's always like that. It's always an awful lot of hard work, but we get so many amazing people there, and it's going to be well worth it.
Okay, well, Munir, that's going to take it to the end of this week's news segment. So I guess I'll see you in the flesh on Sunday, mate, for us.
Yeah, look, I'll see you there at the hotel, mate. We'll have a few beers on the stands.
ZDNet Australia's Munir Katadia there with this week's news. It's time now for this week's feature interview with Dave Endler, Tipping Point's DV Labs Director and the founder and chairman of the VoIP Security Alliance. Dave was in Sydney last week to meet with customers and the press, so Tipping Point flew me down for a natter. As it turns out, Endler was the guy at iDefence who got that company's vulnerability buying program underway. He's a bit of a pioneer in this area. Now he's at Tipping Point, the company behind the Zero Day initiative. They buy bugs so that they can write IPS signatures for their IDS equipment, or IPS equipment. They don't charge extra for the Zero Day SIGs, but it's just like a value add. It's a differentiator for their products. But the ethics in trading and vulnerability information is a tricky area. But it gets even more complicated, and you get even more hairy ethical questions arising from the hacking of online applications. Tipping Point says it will buy software as a service bugs, but as you'll hear, it doesn't actually want to be seen to be encouraging people to find them. It's a bit of a paradox.
Many software as a service vendors think that if you find a bug in their software, the act of you finding a bug is breaking the law. So,
Often it is, isn't it?
By their terms and usage, yeah, but it depends what country you're coming from. Again, the internet is this wild west when it comes to, acceptable use and security. So, again, is it better to remain quiet about a vulnerability you find in one of these services while everyone else is at risk because you're afraid that you're going to get prosecuted?
So we're sort of back to square one. It's like 2000 all over again, right?
Well, I think that's where an intermediary like us can actually come in, and we can preserve the anonymity of our researchers while still getting these bugs fixed.
So you'll actually take a bug on software as a service?
We have in the past. We typically look at how many of our customers at Tipping Point would use that type of service and if they would be benefited by, these bugs being fixed.
So if I put out this to my listeners and say, okay, everybody out there who's like good at web application bug hunting, go and attack salesforce.com right now. Dave Endler wants to give you money. Is that, can you take it to that extreme?
I wouldn't take it to that extreme.
But that's effectively what you're saying, right? Well, that you will take bugs on something like Salesforce.com is very big in the enterprise market. Your customers are going to use that. If someone came forward with a bug in Salesforce.com, would you buy it?
I have to say we'd look at it. We'd look at the criticality. And what we determine when we actually pay for a vulnerability, is it something that we can verify? Now, that's the tricky part, because we typically verify everything in our own lab. So by the very nature of us trying to verify one of these vulnerabilities, we don't want to break the law ourselves. So it's a very murky gray area. I don't have an absolute answer for you. I can say we have very good relationships with some of these providers. So,
but you see how that in itself is a kind of a problem, because just by the virtue of offering payment for vulnerabilities in software as a service, there's sort of like this tacit, this passive encouragement, I suppose, that you're actually helping to nurture what is potentially an illicit market.
Well, I think there's always going to be that view of, I mean, even today, I think there's a misperception in the industry that paying for vulnerabilities actually encourages people to hack software. And, you know, the real...
Now, 8 years later, we all agree that hacking software is good, right?
I don't know that we all agree about that. I think there's still a lot of disagreement in the industry, and it's still a huge misperception. The misperception is once someone sells a vulnerability to us, that once they found it, they introduced that vulnerability into the software. I think that's a huge misperception today that, well, that vulnerability actually existed from the inception of that software, or whenever that software was released.
But we've come a long way in terms of those perceptions. I think, maybe a man on the street might think, well, if they didn't go looking for them, then there wouldn't be a problem. But of course, you and I and everyone in the security industry knows that if the good guy didn't find it, then the bad guy would, right?
I think you're right. We have come a long way, but I think you'd also be surprised, you know, how many people still believe that in the general IT security community, or even the general IT community, there's still a lot of misperception of what you know, security research is, and that, you know, security research is different than hacking. And I think a lot of people these days that discover a vulnerability, they aren't in the elite security houses like you know, X-Force or Bindview or, you know, McAfee Symantec or Tipping Point. These are independent guys. They might not even be in the security industry full time, but these guys are enthusiasts. They're, you know, hip on IT. They really like to play around with software. These guys stumble upon things every day, whether it's in software, whether it's in a service. So if we can encourage them to bring those things to light, not encourage them to actually break into people's sites, but actually bring these things to light that they stumble upon, I think that's the ideal.
But I guess, you know, what I'm seeing here is like a repetition of history with software as a service. It's an interesting tangent that you've taken us down with that. Because, you know, back in the day, I remember when even the act of uncovering a vulnerability, I know guys who would find bugs, they would register a domain, completely anonymize it, create a whole fictitious identity to release that vulnerability to the public, like complete full disclosure. They wouldn't even bother going to the vendor because the vendors were so incredibly hostile towards researchers in the early days of this industry. And they realized that they had to get friendly with these guys or that stuff's going to, you know, keep happening. Do you see the same sorts of things in the future happening with software as a service sort of arrangements? Because, you know, according to Gartner, everything's going online.
So I think it's going to be a huge challenge in the future, because a lot of these software as a service vendors, you know, with the exception of people like Microsoft and Google, they don't understand what security research is, and they don't really make much difference between that and hacking. And so they're going to come after a lot of these guys hard. Even if it was a legitimate security bug that was uncovered through serendipity, through just, you know, going through a normal course of actions, I think they're still going to see back, exactly as you said, in the early days, people are going to probably shy away from reporting these things at first. And so, again, we haven't purchased many of these types of bugs. In the early days at iDefense, we did look at issues in Hotmail and whatnot. But, you know, again, I don't see anyone else other than a strong intermediary like us that pays for it, or someone like a CERT that doesn't pay for it, but that can, you know, approach these vendors with some of these issues.
It's also hard for you guys as an IPS vendor. I mean, like, what are you going to do with a Yahoo webmail bug as an IPS vendor?
Well, we can protect our customers against exploitation until Yahoo fixes the issue.
But what if it's an issue of, you know, say someone's Salesforce.com data being vulnerable to being, you know, sucked off Salesforce.com from another endpoint? I mean, there's nothing you can do about that unless you actually happen to be their IDS, Salesforce.com's IDS provider, right?
Correct. So that's where we'd actually have to look at every type of vulnerability that comes in and see if we could actually do anything about it for our own customers.
And if you can't, then bad luck.
Well, you know, in some cases, we've actually purchased vulnerabilities that we might not be able to do anything about, but we realize they're that important that the vendor would want anyway.
So what, you'll actually put down good money just to be nice?
Yeah, I mean, that's oversimplifying, but yeah, just to be nice. And obviously, we get some marketing value out of the advisory that, you know, eventually comes out.
Marketing value for an advisory, that's pretty old school.
Right, well, you know.
It's all about money these days, Dave, don't you know?
I don't know if it's all about money.
You invented it. Come on, you've turned them all into money-grabbing evil hackers.
Oh, no. I think it's actually a good thing that we've done. And I think that, honestly, you're going to see a lot more evolution in the vulnerability marketplace. We didn't even talk about the black market. Obviously, there was a vulnerability auction that was launched a few months ago. So, you know, things are getting interesting. There's various ways that researchers are getting money out of their vulnerability discoveries, so... it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years.
Now, for something completely different, what's the latest with the VoIP Security Alliance? I understand that you are actually working on a best practices document that's going to be vendor neutral.
Yeah, so Dan York, who's heading that project, he's actually the chair of that project. He's one of our board of directors. And essentially what we've done is we tried to get a first draft moving that is essentially vendor neutral to say, okay, in a VoIP space, in the VoIP application security space, what are some just decent best practices to get you started out of the gate and make sure that all the major vendors like Cisco, Avaya, Nortel, et cetera, agree with those best practices. Then the next step of that project is actually going in specifically for each of those vendors to say, okay, if stage one says, well, enabling encryption and your RTP media stream is a best practice, then we'd actually show in each of those vendor cases, how do you actually do that? So that's the point of the best practice.
So is it going to be like one of those documents like, click on this button and then when you get to this form, enter that sort of thing?
I think so. In stage two, that's what's needed. To be honest, the VoIP security space is still a fledgling industry, and there's still a lot of questions, more questions than answers right now. Even the vendor's supply checklists need a little help, making it more accessible to users.
Yeah, well, it sort of reminds me of the days when there wasn't even a guide on Microsoft's website on locking down IIS, you know?
Right. Now, we've come a long way in the security industry, but we have obviously a long way to go just in, you know, hand-holding users to make themselves more secure. And especially with a new technology like VoIP, you know, it's such an unknown area in terms of security, like what is possible, what's getting exploited. Right now, we're just focusing on the very basic things that hackers are looking at in terms of default passwords, services that haven't been hardened yet, like Telnet, web servers, basic infrastructure attacks against, you know, vulnerabilities that these and the operating system that these VoIP systems are running on.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't realize that most Cisco kit runs, you know, Linux, and it's just they've plugged their pretty iOS thing like on top of it, so everyone thinks, oh, it's an embedded system and it's all on chip, and it's not.
That's right. Well, actually, if you do a search for Code Red on Cisco's website, you'll see one of the hits is how Code Red affected Cisco Call Manager, because at the time
it was on NT, right?
Exactly, and it was running the same vulnerable components. Everyone always asks, when is a worm going to come out that affects VoIP? And the answer is, well, we've already seen many.
2001, worms. Dude.
Exactly. We've already seen a lot of worms come out. So.
Well, I've got to ask too. I mean, this is an obvious question to me, but, you know, everyone keeps crapping on about how 2008 is going to be the big year for mobile exploitation. But, you know, I kind of get the feeling that it could be the big year for VoIP exploitation. I mean, you're obviously going to be biased in your answer to this, but would you go so far as to say that 2008 could really be the year that VoIP hacking catches on?
You know, it's funny. I've been saying 2000X is going to be the year of VoIP exploitation, so I'm not going to go on the record this time. But I will say that, excuse the pun, I think there is going to be a tipping point where you're going to see one or two really compelling events, you know, very public press events that are revolving around VoIP exploitation. And the problem with these things making it to the press is that many organizations are not differentiating VoIP attacks from general network downtime. So they may not actually know that their call manager, Cisco call manager, was affected, or their Cisco routers were affected because of VoIP. They might just think that their organization was targeted. So that's part of the problem in and of itself, that the reporting to the public, if it ever gets to the public, may never actually be related to VoIP. So,
okay, well, Dave Endler, thank you for your time. And also thank you for coming on to Risky Business after a press briefing and not saying either low-hanging fruit, silver bullet, or raises the bar. This is a big thing. So on behalf of Risky Business and our listeners, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Patrick. I appreciate it. Thanks for having us.
Dave Endler there, who I spoke to in Sydney. And just as a disclaimer, as I mentioned before, my flight to Sydney was paid for by Tipping Point. Up next, it's time for our sponsor interview for this week's show. And this week, our show was brought to you by Checkpoint Software. If you listened to Risky Business last week, you would have heard RSA's securities president, Art Coviello, agreeing with Bruce Schneier on one very important issue. Both men say the security industry is dying as a standalone business. Like their companies, BT Counterpane and RSA Security, all security companies will either fail or be absorbed by mega corporations like telcos, integrators, and infrastructure vendors, they say. Now, not surprisingly, Checkpoint Software, which has positioned itself as a standalone security vendor, thinks that's not the case. The company's engineering services manager, Steve McDonald, joined me on the line from Melbourne to throw his two cents into the debate.
Yeah, look, there's no question that consolidation has been an ongoing and repeating factor in the IT security market. But listening to the Risky Business broadcast where Art Coviello made his statements and then reading some additional posts, we're a little confused also as to what his core argument actually is regarding the death of the security industry. Well, you don't consider that consolidation as anything new. If you look at the IT industry's short history, it's really littered with the leftover product data sheets from smaller companies that have been continually acquired and integrated into larger companies. And we think that ongoing consolidation shows healthy innovation, delivering what companies or businesses actually need, rather than a death of an industry.
Well, I kind of agree with that, Steve, because you know, we had a really intelligent fellow on the show a few weeks ago. His name, well, a couple of months ago now. His name's Greg Shipley, and he was suggesting that, you know, we're still trying to work out what is a product and what is a feature. So often you'll see a company pop up that'll have a really good point solution, and then you'll realize that that single point solution belongs as a feature of another product. And sure enough, it's then acquired by a security company, which is then acquired by a, you know, massive professional services or data integration company in turn. I mean, that's always sort of been the way, hasn't it?
Yeah, look, and we continually have customers asking us, looking deeply into the roadmap, looking forward, which new features are we going to bring into the products and at what time. And the primary reason to do that is to ensure that they don't have to put in a whole lot of point solutions with the management overlays. They need to worry about additional training, patching all those additional things. Obviously, customers are looking to have the best security they can at the lowest possible price, delivering the most value to the business, rather than a very complicated and impossible to use solution.
We've seen the trend accelerate, though, over the last few years. You know, you've had Symantec pairing up with Veritas. You've had RSA Security going off with EMC, you know, along with VMware being acquired into that whole trifecta, I guess you'd call it. You know, also IBM has snapped up ISS. There's not really many pure play security vendors of the size of Checkpoint left. I mean, is it conceivable that Checkpoint would be owned by another much larger company one day?
So realistically, we're looking at a lot of companies spending more and more on security with each year. I mean, I think Art quoted 3% of the current IT budget.
And that seems a tad conservative, to be honest.
Yeah, tad conservative. But he's mentioned that that in itself was certainly an issue in that are we any more secure now we're spending all that money, and can we continue to spend that money? So all these companies are trying to get access to that kind of revenue from customers. But we've got to look at that against the backdrop that security is an enablement technology more and more, rather than just expensive insurance or something we have to do. And more importantly, when we look at ourselves, we're spending more money on our personal security every day, taking into consideration your own house, for example, alarms, doors lock, window locks, garage gates, all those kind of things. So just in general, I'd consider we're all spending a lot more money on security. So the larger companies in the industry obviously are looking to leverage their solutions and get access to that revenue.
Well, I think also the Checkpoint experience is an interesting one, because here is a company that made, you know, most of its money. I mean, the reason Checkpoint's such a big company now is because, you know, you guys were the only people selling a good firewall, right, for a number of years. And this was at a time when everybody suddenly realized they need one. So everyone went out and bought one, and Checkpoint was pretty much standing there going, hey, we've got a slick product. And everyone else was still coming to that party. But now what we're seeing with a bunch of things that have traditionally belonged in the security domain, like firewalls, intrusion detection systems, these sort of things, they're increasingly being baked into existing networking technologies. Commercial consolidation is one thing, but what about this sort of technical consolidation we're seeing between networking kit and IDS and firewalling and, you know, operating systems with things like NAC and AV, and everything just sort of seems to be integrating on a technical level as well?
Yeah, look, if we step back 12 years to when I started working in specifically in the IT security market, I imagined a day when I'd look forward and be able to, from a single console, push a holistic policy throughout an organisation, from the desktops to the servers to the gateways to the remote access devices. And I wondered how that would look when we delivered it to market, because it was inevitable. It's here today. Checkpoint is one vendor that provides an end-to-end solution in that regard. And the security threats of the future are going to obviously require those fundamental elements to still be in place for the infrastructure security that people like Hart continue to reference as being something that we need to focus on. But Checkpoint's been around now for 15 years, and we're still developing new areas of security, from the full disk encryption products. For example, we've just released our Mac product for full disk encryption.
Oh, I was just talking about that to a friend last night, actually. I didn't know that had come out, because we were lamenting the lack of full disk crypto for Apple's, we're Mac users. So
So it's there. So it's available from download from Checkpoint's download centres for all customers who have access to that. So that's another example of 15 years or 12 years ago, we probably thought we would need Mac, and then maybe 8 years ago, maybe we weren't sure. But it's a continually changing market with, you know, the goalposts certainly aren't in any one place for too long.
So do you think the views of people like Bruce Schneier and Art Coviello, do you think their views have been shaped by their commercial position in that they've been acquired by, well, in one case, a telco, and in the other case, a storage manufacturer?
Well, look, they've been part of that consolidation process. As a professional, I've been through that myself, and it does change your view of how things operate. But once again, we continue to see many companies go from strength to strength even after they do get acquired. So we certainly hope that he reconsiders his position that was put forward as a DNet, that he may have to retire. Or in 2011, if the security industry isn't dead, obviously that's a bit of tongue-in-cheek from him.
Well, Steve McDonald, thank you very much for taking some time out to chat to us on Risky Business.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Take care.
What can I keep him on them playing style? Take it to play piano, so get out the place, man!
Checkpoint's Steve McDonald there in this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this edition of Risky Business. This week's Sound Foundation track is Dog War by King Tide, and you can buy it for $1.40 from soundfoundation.com. I hope to see you at Ossert on the Gold Coast from this Sunday. Don't forget to point your browser to itradio.com.au/Ossert08 when the conference begins for near real-time interview and news and analysis and all sorts of stuff from the conference floor, even whole presentations. And until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
And a small bungle, don't want to come across big bungle. No need to fight, you can see any animal. Retreat the jump, retreat the hunt. Don't want to wait till the big thing died. Come out in the jungle for the very first time. Broadway bound, mommy feeling so fine. Section 2. Man, the keyboard playing good.